All right. Well, 3 o'clock. Welcome, everyone. I'd like to call to order the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. So hope everyone's enjoying the lovely weather, although I know members, that's kind of a cruel thing to say because members probably haven't been outside at all. But anyway, the first order of business is to call the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland.
Ackland, present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Present.
Golden.
Present.
Damoth.
Damoth is present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen.
Present.
Heal. Excused. Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor.
Present.
Huam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz. Schultz. Wolkema.
Present.
Schultz, present. Wolkema. Wolkema. Madam Chair, quorum is present.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Niedernhofer. So the next order of business is to approve the minutes of March 8th. Is there a member who would care to move approval of the minutes?
Don't move, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Bierman, I saw you first. So Representative Bierman, thank you very much. Moves approval of the minutes of March 8th, 2021. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, if you would unmute yourselves for just a moment, all in favor of approval of the minutes of March 8th, 2021, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? And the motion prevails. Thank you. Okay, so Representative Bierman, I think you're paying attention because you are ready to go for the very first bill. So Representative Bierman has House File 1854, and Representative Bierman's motion is that House File 1854 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And Representative Bierman, please go ahead and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Madam Chair, do we want to move the amendment first?
Well, Representative Bierman, in this case, the amendment is a completely different bill. So I think it might be less confusing if we just deal with the bill as it is, and then we'll move the amendment and discuss that before we adopt it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this bill, to kick us off today on this long day of bills, we have a bill on technical changes to start off with. 1854 is the Department of Human Services Healthcare Policy Bill. And this bill makes policy and technical changes to statutes related to the operations of the medical assistance and Minnesota care programs. In your packets, members, you have summaries. Among the areas addressed in this bill are updates to the child and teen checkups, statutes and rules, the repeal of the Drug Formulary Committee sunset, changes to the Opioid Prescribing Improvement Program. Madam Chair, we have Ann Bobst from the department who is here and could provide a more detailed walkthrough of the bill. I'm not sure of the timing of how much depth you want to go into it, but I think she could give us a good overview and then we could take member questions.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Bierman. Let's go to Ms. Bobst because there isn't a lot in this bill. If we could just get kind of a high level overview, and I think Representative Bierman's given us a good start on that, but welcome, Ms. Bobst.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ann Bobst and I'm with the Department of Human Services. So I'd like to first thank Representative Bierman for preparing this bill for us. And as you mentioned, this is the department's healthcare policy bill. So I will try to provide a brief high-level walkthrough of the sections. And then I do also have policy staff on hand with me who can help answer technical questions. Sections 1 through 5 of the bill clarify where in statute the coverage mandates for the public health care programs are versus where the coverage mandates for private plans are. We often see proposed coverage or benefit mandates in these sections that, if passed, would apply to the managed care plans that offer medical assistance and Minnesota care coverage. This could create different covered benefits between the fee-for-service and managed care populations in our programs. And additionally, in order to receive federal funding for MA services, any new services need to be included in our state plan, which is subject to CMS approval. So any mandates expected to be implemented by the plans that are not in our state plan would not be eligible for federal funding. So this is really just meant to clarify that if mandates are being made for coverage changes in medical assistance in Minnesota care, that those really need to be in 256B and related chapters. Sections 6 through 8 of the bill are primarily technical updates to improve the functions of the Health Services Advisory Council. HSAC, as it is more commonly known, advises DHS in designing healthcare benefit and coverage policies for our publicly funded healthcare programs. These changes include updating the name of the council in statute from the Health Services Policy Committee to the Health Services Advisory Council, which is what it's more commonly known as, clarifying the charge of the council and removing outdated language. It also increases the number of consumer representatives from 1 to 2, expands who can serve as a representative of the mental health provider community, and allows any voting member of the council to serve as chair. Section 9 of the bill repeals the sunset of the Drug Formulary Committee, which is currently scheduled to sunset on June 30th of 2022. The Drug Formulary Committee is a committee of licensed and actively practicing healthcare providers who volunteer to evaluate the safe and effective use of prescription drugs in Minnesota's public healthcare programs. And there's some clarifying language for this change in the amendment as well. Section 10 updates statute for the Child and Teen Checkup Program, which is Minnesota's version of the federally required early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment program. And these changes reflect the current policies and practices needed for us to operate the program. Sections 11 through 13 pertain to the Opioid Prescribing Improvement Program and Opioid Prescribing Workgroup. This will change the two existing consumer seats on the Opioid Prescribing Workgroup from non-voting to voting status. It also allows DHS to share information about prescribers who are in line with standards. Currently, DHS is only allowed to give notice when a prescriber's practice merits quality improvement. Additionally, in the amendment, there's some clarification that a member of MDH sits on the Opioid Prescribing Workgroup as a non-voting member. Section 14 removes the requirement for DHS to enroll qualified professionals who work for PCA agencies as individual providers, and this corrects a drafting error from the final negotiations in the 2019 omnibus. Section 15 is just the revisor instruction to update the name of the Health Services Advisory Committee across statute, and then finally, Section 16 repeals outdated rules related to the Child and Teen Checkup Program. So, Madam Chair, that completes my walkthrough of the bill. As I mentioned, I do have several policy staff on the call with me who can answer questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Bobst. And so, members, why don't we take questions, if there are any, on this bill, and then we'll move to the amendment, which is going to require some other kinds of discussion. Representative Gernhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, to the testifier, according to the summary I have here, why do insurance mandates not apply to state programs? Is there something, could you just address that? Whether they do or not, it doesn't sound like they do. And yet we pass those mandates on the private sector for certain types of coverages.
Thank you, Representative Gernhagen. Ms. Bobst?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can start, and then I may defer to PJ Weiner from the department. Actually, I will just defer to PJ Weiner from the department. She'll be able to answer that better than I will.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you would just introduce yourself, please. Go ahead.
Sure. Madam Chair, my name is PJ Weiner. I am the manager for alternate purchasing for DHS. And so the insurance mandates that are passed generally apply to 62D in and other sections of insurance law. And The Medicaid program benefits are generally in Section 256B, and therefore any insurance mandates that are passed in the insurance sections of law would not apply to the Medicaid program specifically.
Okay, well, I think I understand Representative Grunhagen's question a little bit. And Representative Grunhagen, let me take a stab at the answer and see if I'm understanding it. And then PJ Weiner can correct me if I get it wrong.
Okay,
so what I understand that we're doing here is just reorganizing a little bit, reorganizing the statute so that it's easier to be intentional when you have a piece of legislation. It does get confusing about what it applies to. And my understanding of what they're doing here is just straightening this out so that we don't accidentally apply new legislation where we don't mean to. This is not to say that we make these decisions. The agency doesn't. It's just rearranging the statutory references. Am I kind of close?
Madam Chair, yes, essentially.
Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you. So what this bill is intending to do is address every time a mandate is required that impacts health insurers under HMO law generally, because that's where the managed care plans that participate in the Medicaid program are licensed. Every time a benefit mandate is introduced, those then apply only to those managed care plans and not to our fee-for-service program, because the fee-for-service program statute is under 256B. And as Anne indicated when she went over the section initially, what happens is those mandates then apply only to those managed care organizations and not to the rest of the fee-for-service program. And so this language would exempt those managed care plans from having to cover those mandated benefits unless they are also included in 256B explicitly.
Okay, so is that Representative Grunhagen? So I think what I'm understanding is I was kind of right. She didn't say, no, you're wrong, but I think she's trying to help me out here. And so in other words, we want to make sure that, because I'm not exactly sure what the bill is doing. I guess that's my a little still confusion about this. I'm glad Representative Grunhagen brought it up, but it's making sure that we don't accidentally hit both parts of the program, right? We have to be intentional to make changes in the HMO's part or the fee-for-service part. Is that closer? Ms. Weiner?
Thanks, Madam Chair. That's essentially correct. The goal is to make sure that if a mandate is required on the HMO side, that it would not apply to the medical assistance and Minnesota Care programs unless it is also then included in the medical assistance and Minnesota Care statutes. And so what the language here does is it exempts those HMOs that are participating in those programs as those managed care organizations from having to include those in the benefit package for medical assistance in Minnesota Care unless the benefits are also explicitly covered under 256B, which is the medical assistance section of law. That helped provide some clarification.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Grunhagen, does that help you as well?
Yeah, it's a little less cloudy. If she could repeat that three more times, I think I'd have it. No, just kidding. I think I got the idea.
Okay. Yeah, it is confusing, but I think the key thing in answer to your question is that the agency is not just making these decisions. This is just straightening out the statutory, how the statutes are arranged.
Okay, I appreciate right? that.
And if I'm wrong about that, then somebody needs to jump in and tell me. Okay, apparently I'm not wrong about that. Okay, other questions from members? All right, not seeing any. So let's move on then and take up the amendment. So Representative Bierman, you have the A1 amendment. Would you like to move that?
Yes, Madam Chair, please. I'd like to move the A1.
All right. And then Representative Bierman, do you want to explain what the A1 is?
Yes, Madam Chair. The A1, part of it was referred to already by Ms. Bobst. It's an additional clarification to removing the sunset of the Drug Formulary Committee to conform a similar language for other advisory committees. It also clarifies that a member of MDH sits on the opioid prescribing work group as a non-voting member. This language was requested to be added by MDH. Also adds the Department of Public Safety language that is needed to modify the Minnesota Child Protection Background Check Act to reflect updated federal authorities. And this language is needed in order to provide the most complete and accurate criminal history information to hiring entities who provide services and supports to the elderly and people with disabilities. And Madam Chair, we do have a DPS staff are available to answer technical questions on this language as well.
Okay, thank you, Representative Bierman. And I see that Representative Munson has his hand up. And Representative Munson, I was gonna go to Drew Evans from the BCA to talk about this part. Is your question to the first part of the bill?
It's to the opiate work group portion of the bill.
Okay, that was in the first part of the, we're on to the amendment right now, so maybe we could hold off on that. Let me go to Drew Evans and we'll come back to after we adopt the amendment, because I think that's right, Representative Bierman, that's in the first part, the opioid
part.
Well,
there was one clarification in the about MDH having a member, but in the previous part of the bill, there were additional members added to be patient advocates that are now going to be voting members rather than non-voting members.
Okay, so well, let's go to Drew Evans and then let him explain his part here, and then we can go back and discuss. Okay. So Mr. Evans, Superintendent Evans, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And the piece that we are discussing with you today does a couple things. I'm going to start in reverse order, and I won't go through line by line, but to draw your attention to line 7.6, there is additional language that allows for background checks on current employees. The current statute allows for background checks only on applicants. And to create compliance with recommendations from the FBI, it would allow for us to do background checks on current employees in line with their recommendations. So for example, people that are in a position of trust that are state or that are licensees or are county or local government officials, as recommended by the FBI, would allow you to do that. As the representative noted, and now moving to the bulk of the bill, the Minnesota Child Protection Background Act was originally passed in 1992 in response to federal legislation that was referred to at the time as the National Child Protection Act and Volunteers for Children Act that went into effect in 1993. That was also expanded beyond children, and that's the relevance in particular for your committee, to include background checks for the well-being of elderly and individuals with disabilities in 1994, but our statute was never updated to reflect this change. And so that's part of the change that's suggested here as the federal government, again, in 2018, the Federal Child Protection Improvements Act amended that NCPA/VCA that I referred to before by requiring a national program that allows a qualified entity to utilize the federal program and bypass the state altogether. Why this is important for Minnesota is that we do not want entities bypassing the BCA background check process that we're responsible for, and in particular because the entities that may be using this would not get a complete picture, as Minnesota, meaning the BCA, houses additional information that would not be available to the federal entity, so they would not get that complete picture when they're doing a background check for these individuals. And importantly for this group, the Department of Human Services is operating under an extension currently from the FBI for background checks that would be encompassed here for many of their programs. And this language would allow that to continue. That extension that they currently have would expire on August 1st of 2021. But if we are to pass this language moving forward, we would be able to use those checks here. Importantly, and I'll stand for questions, this does not expand background checks in any way in Minnesota. It simply clarifies the language so that they flow through the BCA, and it ensures the background checks that are occurring today would be able to continue on past that August date.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Superintendent Evans. And so, so Representative Munson, I know your question's not to this, so if we can hold on yours, unless you tell me you have a question to this, I'm going to go to Representative Dama.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make sure in this amendment, is this changing the, to Representative Bierman, is this changing the opiate work group members from voting to non-voting or adding them but not making them voting members? Is that what the amendment is doing?
Representative Bierman? Madam Chair, Representative Munson, they become voting members. The two non-voting members right now will become voting members.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. Yep.
All right. Representative Dama. Oops, you're muted.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question with the DPS language. Will that be heard in public safety?
I believe it already has been, Representative Damath. Is that correct, Representative Bierman?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's my understanding. It's been heard in public safety already.
Excellent. Thank you.
Representative Damath, okay. Other questions to this part, to the amendment? And we'll go back to Representative Munson, but I just want to clarify, and this is one of the reasons we wanted to be sure to have the to have this piece of language heard in this committee. And that is because I just wanted to clarify with Superintendent Evans, and your explanation was helpful. You know, we already, when I looked at this bill language, I was kind of, don't we do this already? Because in human services, we certainly, you know, do all kinds of background examinations, and adding the elderly and people with disabilities, I think, is what this is doing. It was kind of like, why do we need to do that? We already do that. So I just wanted to understand, you know, what the necessity for this was and if it was duplicating something or adding something new that we're not doing. And from your explanation, I'm understanding that it's not adding anything new. Could you just give me just a bit more comfort on that, if you would.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, that is exactly right. You often in your committee deal with a number of background check statutes related to health and human services. There was a particular one that you passed, and just if any of members are not familiar, the way it works for a federal background check to be approved is we need to have a state law that is passed, and then it needs to be approved by the Attorney General of the United States. They do not offer preemptive decisions for us. We have to pass the law and then make that request to them at that time. And the BCA works with a number of different entities to provide language based on our background and experience to make sure that that passes. There is one particular, through some audits and a number of background checks that have been occurring under state law, that do not qualify as part of that audit process, and then also that language that did not pass. This would ensure that the statutes that you have approved would fold underneath this, and so it is not expanding background checks. It is ensuring the checks that are occurring today that you're aware of continue to occur under this language.
All right. Thank you for that. Are there other questions for members related to this background study piece? All right, not seeing any. So I think we are ready then to adopt the amendment, and then we can have some more discussion and get back to Representative Munson's question, which I think is still maybe on the bill as a whole after we adopt the amendment. So Representative Bierman is moving adoption of the A1 amendment, and we can do this on a voice vote. So if members would unmute yourselves. All in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And then Representative Munson, to back to your question or to other questions you might have.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members and Representative Bierman for particularly for adding this provision on line 730 to add two members to the working group who are to the opioid work group who are who have used opiates. I think that was after the opioid law passed a couple of years ago. I heard from a lot of chronic pain patients about being restricted in by their doctors, and I think you and I both met with one of your constituents about that issue too. Mike, I guess I don't really like work groups being set up because I think they're usually constructed in a way that you equally balance the group enough so that they really don't get anything done. And this provision says two consumer members who are Minnesota residents and who have or are using opiates to manage chronic pain. So if you choose somebody that used to use opiates and no longer does, and you pick somebody that currently does, they're probably going to cancel each other's vote in the committee. So I guess I would just, I will see how this work group goes, but I appreciate at least adding the members to the group and actually giving them a voice or a vote. So I'm in favor of that provision. We'll get to the rest of the bill later on, but I just want to thank you for adding that.
All right. Thank you, Representative Munson. Representative Bierman, any comment or response on that point?
Madam Chair and Representative Munson, I see your point, and I've attended a couple of those meetings and listened in, and I just think it is important to have, like you said, the variety of voices at the table. I think it's very important. When they show up and they just get to testify, it's a little different than when they're sitting at the table with colleagues, essentially, than to have a more even footing. So I think that's an important change. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. So any other questions on the bill as amended? All right. I'm not seeing any. Representative Bierman, did you want a final word then on the bill as amended before we lay it over?
Madam Chair, just thank you to the members for listening. And there's a lot of different various details here, but I think they're all good, and we'll make life easier for DHS to make everything work better in our healthcare system. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. So with that, House File 1854 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So thank you to our testifiers. Okay, Representative Fisher, nice to have you with us. Representative Fisher is not on our committee, so the chair will move House File 162 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Thank you, committee, for the opportunity to present House File 162. This is a bill that addresses a underlying problem that we have that a number of the youth who are homeless in our state face. And any given night, we have about 6,000 youth that are homeless, and about 2,500 of them are going to be 17 or younger, and 3,500 will be between the ages of 18 and 24. The number of people who are usually people of color is usually around 73%, and many of the folks who are homeless, many of these homeless youth have been homeless for a year or longer. A number of them experience domestic violence, neglect, parental abuse. About one third actually have kids of their own out there, and 57% suffer from serious mental illness. To ensure that young people not only survive in Minnesota, but are able to thrive and achieve their highest potential, it is incumbent on us as policymakers to provide them with the services and other services they need to meet those goals. So often though, the barriers that they need, the services they have to get and receive a lot of times carry barriers with them. Some of those barriers to us don't seem very large, but for them it is very hard to overcome. And the biggest barrier is being able to secure an ID or even a birth certificate. Right now, current law is set up that for a youth who is under the age of 16 to get a birth certificate, if they don't have a family member along, they're not able to access that information. And without a birth certificate, you can't get an ID card. Without an ID card, you have trouble getting government support services. You have trouble getting access to educational services. for those who are trying to work. You can't even get a job. You can't get a bank account. So all of a sudden, something as simple as having an ID card for these youth who are homeless become a barrier where it causes them to continue to fail. And so what we wanted to do is try to address that problem. In January 15th of 2020, the Department of Public Safety and Human Services came out with a memo to address this issue, Shay. We need to fix the problem. And so my bill I have in front of us today addresses the problem and addresses the issues that was raised in this letter that was sent out. Part of it is, first of all, addressing from the ID standard. To be able to do the ID through public safety, they have to set it up in such a way that it would be doing the non-compliant ID, which means it cannot be used to satisfy the requirements that the federal government has for being able to get into a federal courthouse or being able to get onto a plane or even going across the borders, those kind of things. What it does is it means that it would be just a regular Minnesota state ID card that would allow you to be identified within the state. And the reason there's a difference on this, and this was discussed through the Public Safety Committee, is because if the federal government has standards on there that we are not able to waive. And so as a result, we are at that lower level of the non-compliant ID. And that's why we have that in there, because that is defined in that statute. The cost then that there that would be waived is typically for the ID costs $21.50. And so this bill would also waive that in the process. For the purview of this committee, the big changes are with the birth certificate. Some of the changes, one that I mentioned earlier, is that it would allow youth who are unaccompanied to be able to get a birth certificate if they are under the age of 16. That is set in statute, so that would waive that provision. In addition to that, it would also allow the person who is applying to be able to apply for it and receive it for free. And typically that cost, and I've got it written down here, the birth certificate normally costs $26. And so what we would do is we would waive that. And that is part of the fiscal note that I have that accompanies this. In addition, is one of the things that we would do with the birth certificate is we would have a expiration date on it. Because one of the problems that homeless youth experience is that because they're not in a stable environment, it is not unusual for documents to become lost or misplaced as they're going from one place to another. Sometimes it's living in a box underneath a bridge, in a tent in a park. And as a result, those places are not real secure. But we want to make sure that if that birth certificate becomes separated from the youth, that it has an expiration date on, so nobody else tries to use it to replicate that person's name for financial fraud. So that is one of the recommendations that was made and that we have as a provision in there. And then finally, as I mentioned about the cost, is there is a fiscal note for it, and the fiscal note over a two-year program, for the 2 years of the program, is estimated to be $181,000. I will pause at that point for any questions that you may have.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Representative Fisher. And just to point out to members that the fiscal note was sent out in your packets. So if you see me kind of looking to the side here, it's because I have the materials on another screen. And so I'm trying to, it's hard to work remotely, right? But I do have that in front of me, and you all do have that in your materials as well. So $181,000 in the first biennium, $102,000 in the second biennium. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for clarification, I'd like the committee sent a list of all the programs requiring an ID. There are many health programs of where ID would be required and useful for signing up and getting those. I think that's appropriate for the committee to understand that aspect of this bill. And the other thing is the address that would be put on it would maybe have some relevance as to what county some of the they'd be signing up program-wise. And, you know, some of those clarifications I think are quite relevant, if the author could enlighten. And then offline can the chair maybe can make sure we get passed on the programs that require a photo ID. Thank you.
Well, Representative Quam, Representative Fisher, do you want to respond? I know this bill's in through a number of committees.
Right. This has been through a lot of committees. In terms of the programs, I do not have a list with me that lists all the different programs where you need to have the ID. I do know that anytime you apply for a job, you have to have that ID when you're applying for the job. Anytime that you're trying to get a bank account, you need to have an ID, photo ID with you to verify who you are going in. From there, all the other services, I would have to go back to the Department of Health and Public Safety to see if they've got a complete listing of what they may have. And I would say that it would not surprise me if what we come up with may only be a partial, because different businesses, depending what they're working with, will have different standards when you're working with different identification things. And in other words, other parts of the financial sector may have requirements when you're trying to do things, and that I just don't know. And it might be hard to get some of the information, but we will do our best to get a list.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Fisher. And we will see if we can get that from MDH and DHS, although it's the kind of thing that I doubt that such a list exists, but we'll ask and see if we can.
Madam Chair, the address also, thank you, Madam Chair, the address that would be on there, because, you know, the county of residence sometimes affects what programs and how they're implemented, you know.
Representative Fisher?
I'm trying to remember, is there somebody, I know that we've got somebody from Department of Human Services on there. Was there anyone from the Department of Public Safety that had also, because I can only take a guess from what I've seen used in my experience. I know that when we've worked with homeless youth, they've used the address of the facility that they're staying at, even though that may only be a short-term stay, that is the address that is used. But I cannot give a complete answer because I'm sure there's more that goes into that than what I'm providing right there.
Okay, so I understand that Molly Crawford from MDH is on. I don't know, Molly Crawford, if you can help us out here with this question. Welcome.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Molly Crawford, the State Registrar for the Department of Health, State Registrar of the Office of Vital Records. I can help a little bit. I can speak to birth certificates, and no address is on a birth certificate. It's sent to somebody or given to them in person when they request it. I do believe a birth certificate can be used to get a Social Security card, and no address then is associated there. The interesting thing is an ID is often used, a photo ID is often used to obtain a birth certificate, and Representative Fisher has done an excellent job in carving out language in this bill to allow for a homeless youth who does not have a photo ID to still get the birth certificate. And I'm sorry, I can't help further.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for that. Okay, I think we're ready to finish up with House File 162. Representative Fisher, do you want to have a closing comment?
Just very quickly, I want to say thank you to the committee for the opportunity to present the bill. I strongly encourage your support in including this funding in your omnibus bill so that we can make sure that we ensure that our young people who are experiencing homelessness are being set up for success in the future by having the basic documents that they need to be able to get the education and the jobs and the bank accounts so that they can be successful like the rest of us. Thank you for your time today.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your work on this, Representative Fisher. With that, House File 162 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. All right, we've got House File 1918, Representative Ryer, and the motion there, Representative Ryer's motion, is that House File 1918 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. House File 1918 focuses on establishing the dental home concept to improve access to dental care for public program members, especially children. This idea has wide support from the governor to the Department of Health to the critical access dental provider community who were instrumental in drafting this legislation. I'm pleased to present it to you today. As we heard in Mr. Matt Anderson's briefing last month on Medicaid and Minnesota Care Dental Group programs, Minnesota has longstanding access problems. I'll remind you of one data point. The share of kids getting dental care on medical assistance, less than 40%. This is a core health and equity problem that we are obligated to address for both practical and moral reasons. We also have a reimbursement problem. Minnesota comes in 49th in reimbursing providers for providing care to medical assistance members, and we have an extremely complex administrative and rate system. Within this environment, many proposals have been advanced to try and attract more providers through rate increases and administrative simplification. This includes proposals to eliminate the Critical Access Dental, or CAD, program, which pays CAD providers an added 37.5%. That funding would be put into the overall base rate in hope of enticing additional dentists to treat more Medicaid enrollees. This raises concerns among the CAD providers who currently serve a majority of Medicaid patients, as shown in research conducted by AppleTree Dental, Community Dental Care, and HCMS's dental clinic. So about a year ago, a group of CAD dentists began meeting to consider options for creating an alternative incentive program that was aligned with DHS's goals of continuity of care and a value-based system. These meetings were also referenced in Mr. Anderson's overview last month. The group settled on a dental home model because of the success of medical and behavioral health home models. These are best described as an approach to care that is patient-centered, comprehensive, team-based, coordinated, accessible, and focused on quality and safety. Dental homes are not necessarily buildings or places. They extend beyond the walls of a clinical practice. These dental homes will build partnerships with clinical specialists, families, and community resources by providing care to populations within community settings and using innovative workforce models in places like schools, shelters, group homes, and congregate living. This approach also lends itself to culturally specific care and helps address disparities in health outcomes. This is a promising approach to solve this enduring problem. By passing House File 1918, we authorize an advisory committee to develop recommendations for a dental home pilot, and recommendations are due by December 15, 2021. This will be a focused group encompassing all providers, stakeholder groups working together to help us move forward in delivering the care our MA and Minnesota Care members deserve. In closing, I want to acknowledge the work these dental providers have done this past year and their passion for caring for Minnesota Healthcare Program enrollees. Next, I'd like to invite Dr. Sheila Riggs to testify. Dr. Riggs is the chair of primary dental care at the University of Minnesota's School of Dentistry. She also happens to be my constituent. She has chaired the large overall group this year to develop an outline of what a dental home could entail. Thank you. I'll look forward to your questions and ask for your support.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Representative Ryer. And Dr. Riggs. Dr. Riggs is familiar to us here in this committee, or in previous years at least. So welcome, Dr. Riggs, and glad to have you with us. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Sheila Riggs, and I chair the Department of Primary Dental Care at the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry. And I chair the Dental Services Advisory Council within the Department of Human Services also. I want to start by thanking my state rep, Representative Ryer, for authoring this important legislation. For several years, the Critical Access Dental Program has been at the center of the debate over how to increase access to oral health care for individuals on Minnesota's public programs. About 15 months ago, I convened a large group of us CAD, or Critical Access Dental providers, after a few providers purchased data from DHS. It showed that fewer than 300 of us CAD providers in the state account for over two-thirds of the Medicaid enrolled dental workforce. We all agree that elimination of the CAD program without something designed to replace it would put the entirety of the safety net provider community in financial peril. However, while the safety net provider community absolutely relies on the CAD program to keep its doors open, We also understand that not enough people are able to access care, and we need to evolve in order to better serve Minnesota. That's why we have brought forward this legislation. We believe a dental home delivery model would meet the oral health needs of Minnesotans while also providing the provider reimbursement that is based on the care they provide and the outcomes we all achieve. A patient-centered dental home is a model of care that is accessible as it allows for multiple entry points into care for the enrollee and uses the entirety of oral health workforce in innovative ways to ensure continuous and coordinated care that is patient and family-centered. Our new coalition, the Minnesota Dental Homes Collaborative, is committed to working with the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services and other stakeholders to develop dental home pilot projects with many elements and strategies that will need to be demonstrated and evaluated. This development process should be deliberate and data-driven. We need to improve access to dental services and improve outcomes through evidence-based innovations, workforce changes, a more suitable and ethical benefit set to improve oral enrollee health while demonstrating value for taxpayer dollars. Lastly, while we are incredibly excited about the prospects of the dental home concept, we know it's going to take time to develop and pilot and implement. As we work through the process, we believe that the Critical Access Dental Program remains vital to preserving patient access and clinical infrastructure. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions any of you might have.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Riggs. We appreciate your testimony. Members, are there any questions? Okay, not really seeing any. This is great. Representative Ryer and Dr. Riggs and the others who have been working on this, I really appreciate this. We've been struggling with this issue. As members who have been here know, that this is a constant struggle, and it's a struggle for our state of how we can do better with getting dental care and improving the dental health of the people on our public program. So I really appreciate your work. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I couldn't find my hand raised there for a minute, so thank you for waiting. I just wanted to thank Representative Ryer for getting to work on this and getting a bill up and having an option. You know, the statistics that you talked about at the beginning of us being 49th in the 50 states under this is just an abhorrent statistic that I think we need to find ways to improve that immediately. And I think this pilot program, you know, is something that we should be looking at to try and to see how that could work out. And just the question I had was this pilot plan that Dr. Riggs referred to a number of elements of it. My question is, were you borrowing anything from other states, or is this sort of just a Minnesota grown plan based on your experience and the experience of the stakeholders gathered?
So, Dr. Riggs, do you want to take that? I don't, or Representative Ryer can. Okay, Dr. Riggs.
Yeah, so there's no perfect dental home model upon which to draw. There is some evidence that we will be bringing in as threads as we design, but we really do believe it's going to be more Minnesota-based because we have the workforce innovations that so many other states don't have. So we will absolutely be using the evidence that's available, but making it a Minnesota style.
Just one follow-up, Madam Chair. So then, you know, the providers are out there right now. I've seen, you know, examples of some really innovative clinics that are really treating a lot of people in very imaginative ways. And my question is, as you think about this pilot program, would you try to sprinkle it throughout the state, or were you thinking just like a couple to try them out to start? Small scale or large scale?
Dr. Riggs.
Well, I think that's to be determined. I think a part of the architect work group will be about designing the pilots. And we actually think that what we'll find that a lot of the clinics you know of are doing some really innovative things. So it may become really just demonstration projects that evaluate some of the innovations already. And so that's why we think of it, yes, as a pilot program, but there's a lot of elements that will need to be tested and evaluated.
Thank you, Dr. Riggs. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question for the author or maybe one of the testifiers. I understand the American Academy has been, AAPD has been using this model or have been recommending this for two decades or several decades, but do we know of any dentist in Minnesota that has already utilized this model? And it seems like a very good idea. And if they haven't, what's been the roadblock for this? Because obviously we want to give good care to children, we get that. But has someone been able to utilize this? Are we working from that utilization? And if not, what do you think's been the roadblock? Thank you. That's my only question, Chair.
All right. I see Ms. Erickson is here as well. I don't know who wants to answer it. Ms. Erickson, did you want to try to answer that? All right. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tara Erickson, and I am the contract lobbyist for Dental Access Partners. Thank you, Representative Becker, for your question. I think some of the current critical access dental providers are doing a lot of the work right now that could be seen as a dental home model. They are doing hub and spoke. They are going out into the community. The problem has been that there are administrative barriers and reimbursement issues that have not been allowed, whether that is collaborative practice dental hygiene within school settings. And so we want to be able to look at this from a very holistic standpoint and say how many different programs are out there that we're not able to utilize right now because of reimbursement issues, and then integrate those into our community so that our enrollees can have many different entry points, again, whether it's schools or other community settings.
Representative Backer.
Thank you, I appreciate it. Just wanted to know some of those details and how we can provide those a good level of care. Thank you, that was a good answer, thank you.
All right, well, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Erickson. Okay, so, once again, Representative Ryer, thank you for your work on this. You know, I just want to comment. It's really easy to criticize the system we have now, which is not doing very well. It hasn't been for a long time. And, of course, finding a good solution and a better way to deliver care is the hard part. And thank you to all those who are actually working on trying to find the solution, because we badly need it. We can't have a healthy population with rotting teeth. That we know. So, Representative Ryer, final word.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Riggs and Ms. Erickson, for your support in this today. And I just want to say, I feel like right now we have a great opportunity to take innovations from past dental experiences, to Representative Backer's point, to other areas of healthcare, and see what we can do, because we have an opportunity and an obligation to use our state resources well. So thank you all for your support for this.
All right. So with that, House File, let's see, I lost the number here. House File 1918 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Thank you. Okay. So next on the list, I think we're going to make a little bit of a change here, members. Next on the list, we had Representative Morrison's bill, but I understand there's an issue with a testifier needing to leave. So if it's okay with everyone, especially with Representative Morrison, I think we would take up House File 1197 next, which is Representative Bonner's bill. Okay, seeing no objection to that, and okay, great. So, so the motion here, Representative Bonner is a member of our committee, and the motion, her motion is that House File 1197 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And Representative Bonner, I understand you have an amendment. Would you like to?
I do, Madam Chair. I would like to move the A1 amendment.
All right, so let's move the A1. She has moved the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which she'd like to discuss it, and then we could adopt that, and then we could discuss what that does. So if you would unmute yourselves, members, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Bonner, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. You know, in this committee and the Early Childhood Committee, we often discuss the awe-inspiring value of a child's development in the first few years of life. Their little brains developing and growing their whole lives, setting up before them. Their motor skills develop, their brain synapses flourish, their personalities and their experiences form the foundation of the road to come. And it sets the stage for their success in education and in life. But not every story starts with a happy beginning, and not every mother starts with the tools to love and nurture her little one, to realize the dreams of what they could become. And not every family has the resources or the skills to help this new life reach its full potential. We have before us a bill that has the power to change that. Home visiting is a program that has a power to shape futures by shaping and nurturing families who are most at risk due to poverty, language barriers, substance abuse, and often the lack of skills to model the nurturing behaviors that many never experienced in their own childhood. Here's what we know. The need is real. The benefit profound. Nearly 90% of families we could help will never get it. That's 81,000 families that we are not helping today because we lack the resources or the funds to intervene early. The window of opportunity to change the trajectory of these young lives is limited. COVID has laid bare the even more stark need for this vital work, with many families struggling from unemployment, housing, and food insecurity, depression, and anxiety. We know from studies that early intervention has the power to save the state money, reduce dependence on state services over the long run, but the real return on investment is the potential to raise multiple generations out of poverty, to slam the door on education gaps before they get a foot in the door, to impart the wisdom of mothers to find within themselves the skills to nurture their children and their future. This bill asks us to lead by providing the services families desperately need and the outcomes we so desperately want. Here's a few facts just to bring it home. The cost of inaction is steep. Traumatic early childhood experiences disrupt brain development, lead to poor emotional, behavioral, cognitive health issues, and language development. In 2019, over 3,500 babies and young children were victims of maltreatment. Many enter the foster care system where they remain, causing further trauma. But the benefits to home visiting are compelling. For kids, it means improved health and development, increased parent-child attachment, increased kindergarten readiness. For moms, it means decreased depression, decreases in child abuse and maltreatment, reductions in alcohol and drug use, and increased employment. This bill has the potential to meet 100% of the need for Minnesota families. It makes basic policy changes to include evidence-informed and promising practices and defines the terms for clarity. These programs connect families to critical services and position them to thrive, not just survive. And with that, Madam Chair, I do have a testifier here today, and I do have Ms. LaCroix de Lune here as well for questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Bonner, and your testifier, Ms. McDonald. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is LaSheria McDonald. I'm here today representing St. Paul Ramsey County Public Health as a home visitor and a health educator. I'm also here representing the Minnesota Targeted Home Visiting Coalition. The coalition represents a broad array of nonprofit organizations, local public health agencies, tribal health agencies, and local education home visiting programs. I'd like to take a few minutes to share my personal experience as a parent who received home visiting services. I know firsthand that these early interventions have a positive lifelong impact on families and children. I got pregnant in the eighth grade while I was 14 years old. Being a teen mom, you get your share of judgmental looks and comments. The awful looks and comments filled me with guilt, shame, and embarrassment. I was living in poverty when I got pregnant, so I had to get on welfare and sign up for WIC to make sure that I could provide for my baby. WIC referred me to Ramsey County Public Health because they offered voluntary home visiting services to help young moms who are interested in support. I began meeting with my first public health nurse when I was pregnant and throughout my son's first year. I aged out of the first evidence-based program, and then I started receiving home visiting services from the second public health nurse in a different home visiting program. During my visits, a public health nurse, the first one, would measure my stomach, weigh me, and educate me on how my unborn child was developing in my womb. My first public health nurse was also supportive emotionally because she made sure that we always had time to talk about what I was struggling with that week. After my son was born, a public health nurse would weigh my baby, do screenings to make sure he was on track developmentally, and so much more. My public health nurse would also ask how I was coping with being a new mom and how she could be supportive. My second public health nurse would talk to me about parenting topics such as healthy nutrition and discipline. She connected me to any resource that I need, such as food shelves, employment opportunities, and mental health services. My public health nurse helped me to understand my child's development and his behaviors through the child developmental screening methods. My public health nurse would check in to see how I was doing as a person and how she could support me. Meeting with my public health nurses was the highlight of my day. Home visiting was important to me because my public health nurses, they never judged me. When they looked at me, they didn't see just a teen mom. They saw a mom who was trying to raise her son while completing high school on welfare. I felt listened to and heard during my home visits. My public health nurses educated me on the skills I needed to parent my child the best way I could. I felt like my public health nurses understood me because of the empathy they always displayed towards me. With support from my public health nurses, I was able to finish school while being a teen mom. They helped me to access resources to meet our basic needs while being emotionally supportive. After I graduated from high school, both my public health nurses wrote me letters of recommendation for my St. Catherine University application. I graduated from St. Case in 2017. Now I'm employed at the exact same organization and work in the exact same unit as my public health nurses. I am officially out of poverty. I'm married and my children are thriving. I feel like I'm a better mom, professional, and woman because of home visiting. So home visiting is important to me because I love what I do. The reason why I went to St. Case was to obtain a degree that would allow me to be a home visitor. I feel like it's my turn to reach back and help get young moms out of poverty. I know what a lot of my clients are going through because I've walked in their shoes. I hope to be a reminder to moms that you can get out of poverty, raise your kids in a healthy way, and live the life that you desire. I enjoy bonding with families and helping them get connected to resources they need. I enjoy working with moms on building healthy attachment with their children, talking about child development and the well-being of their family. At the end of the day, I truly feel like I'm making an impact on the families I serve, just like my public health nurses made an impact on my life. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Ms. McDonald. That's really, really wonderful. Congratulations to you. And thank you so much for sharing your story. It's very, very, very touching and inspiring. I don't see any questions from members. Representative Pryor.
I guess I just have a comment. And Well, it's so great to see you again, Ms. McDonald, and to hear your story again. And we did, because we did hear it in the early childhood. And I'm glad that you, I mean, we are very grateful that you took the time to come here and share that personal story, and that we all benefit from hearing, you know, it's not just this is what a public health nurse does, but to know that the impact that that can have. And then when you make that choice to go back and to help all of the ways that you were helped, you know, that just gives us inspiration for why we try to do what we're doing here. And I have to say to Representative Boehner, you know, we always say, well, thank you for bringing this bill forward. But I don't think I've ever meant it more than when I'm saying it now. Thank you. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. It really gets to what we're trying to do, I think, as representatives and on this committee and talking about public health and in a way that is science-based and results-oriented and really is the investment that we know has been documented that really pays off. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Any other questions from members? And before we finish up, we didn't actually talk about what the amendment was that we adopted here. Representative Bonner, do you just want to mention that so members, you know, feel comfortable about what we did?
Yeah, and I'm sorry, you know, I kind of glossed over it a little bit in the context there. Essentially, this bill, the base bill, is mostly about policy and adding in evidence-based and evidence-informed items, which often are culturally appropriate. But what the amendment actually does is, so we now have a base budget in this bill that covers about 10% of the real need that we have. The actual need, if we were to cover 100% of our families, and this is before COVID, is about $278 million. That's a pretty hefty investment. Certainly, we know that realistically, we have lots of competing needs in the state of Minnesota, and we may or may not be able to go all the way to 100%. But the amendment really adds the ability for us, once we get our targets, to make real investments in this program. We know it works. We know the outcomes are there. We know it has the potential to really, you know, not only save the state money and provide better outcomes, but to really solve this issue for literally multiple generations to come. And so essentially, this is just giving us the opportunity with this amendment to add some additional funding on the base once we get those targets available.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. In other words, it's a blank appropriation that will allow us to fill it in to see how much we have available to fund the program. And thank you for that. So, Representative Bonner, final word before we lay the bill over?
Just one brief moment of gratitude again for Ms. McDonald for sharing her story here today. Her energy is infectious. Her dedication and her passion, I think, speak for the program in such a way that we couldn't otherwise. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. All right. With that, House File 1197, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Thank you both very much. Okay, Representative Morrison, thank you for letting us do that little switch in order there. So Representative Morrison is moving House File 572 to be re-referred to the Tax Committee. So this is a bill that we're going to be moving out of committee today. So, Representative Morrison, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present House File 572. It gives the legislature a third option for how to invest the needed resources in tobacco prevention and treatment. This bill dedicates $15 million annually from existing tax revenues, cigarette tax revenues. The other two bills that we've discussed in this committee, House File 569 and House File 1410, appropriate general fund revenue and delinquent settlement payments. At the end of the day, we now have three good options. And the bottom line is we need to increase our investment in reducing the harm of commercial tobacco. We've made a lot of progress over the past few decades, but there's more work to be done. While smoking rates are down, we're still facing a youth vaping epidemic, significant tobacco-related health disparities, and the upcoming closure of Clearway, Minnesota, who has provided the majority of prevention funding in our state for over two decades. It's very clear, now is the time to do more to prevent youth tobacco use and treat tobacco addiction. Last year, the state of Minnesota collected over $600 million in tobacco taxes. It would be very appropriate to dedicate some of those tobacco tax revenues to tobacco prevention and treatment. Currently, there are two existing dedications, one for the Academic Health Center and one for medical education and research. This bill would add a third dedication. Dedicating a small portion of existing tobacco tax revenues to health is one way to make a smart investment for lowering our healthcare costs, protecting our kids, and lessening health disparities. Thank you for hearing the bill today, and I look forward to working together to find a solution to the tobacco prevention funding gap. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Morrison, for covering this issue for us so well. It's so important. And so are there any questions from members? I want to make sure we know what, because we are going to be voting now on this bill. So,
Madam Chair?
Yeah, Representative Freiberg.
Sorry, I'm on my phone and don't have access to the raise hand feature. I was just wondering, maybe Representative Morrison could answer. I know tomorrow in the Preventive Health Division, we'll be looking at a bill related to that would actually increase the rates on commercial tobacco products. I guess I'm just wondering if she has thought if the current rates are sufficient.
Okay, so did you catch the question, Representative Morrison?
Madam Chair,
Representative Morrison, now we can't hear you.
What? Can you hear me now, Madam Chair?
Now I can, yes.
Sorry about that. Zoom life. I believe Representative Freiberg asked if current tobacco tax revenue is adequate.
I think that was the gist of his question. I know he's on the phone here. Representative Freiberg, does that sound like what you wanted to know?
Yes.
Yes.
I don't know that I can speak to that. This bill focuses on the current level of taxation on tobacco products. There's certainly a fulsome conversation to be had about how much we should be taxing tobacco products, and there's certainly an argument to be made for taxing them more. But that's not what this bill is about.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Morrison. Mr. Berg, did you want to make a comment?
Madam Chair, just for reference, since I recently answered this question, the cigarette and tobacco products tax brings in approximately $582 million in fiscal 22 to the state general fund.
Right. And Mr. Berg, how much of that goes to actually tobacco activities? Do you have that number?
Yes, it's zero.
Okay.
Well, we started last year, you'll recall the committee, we did appropriate some money to the Department of Health to start a tobacco products, tobacco cessation program. They also deal with that to some degree in the SHIP program. But as far as how much money is dedicated out of the general fund, I mean, members tend to think there is some dedicated stream from the tobacco settlement. There is not.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Berg. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Mr. Berg, I believe. Do we get any reports back from the University of Minnesota for that $22 million that is appropriated to the Academic Health Center about their efforts on tobacco prevention or public health?
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, I don't believe there's a direct link between that appropriation and any particular set of reports. The genesis of that dedication and statute, if members remember, way back when with the original tobacco settlement, in addition to the perpetual payments to the general fund and the setting up of Clearway, the settlement set up, I believe it was three substantial endowments, the income from which went to various purposes. One of them was primarily, the university was the primary beneficiary of it. In, I don't recall, probably 2010, the state cashed in all its endowments. And as part of that, so the university lost the benefit of those investments, but instead the $22 million was dedicated to purposes of the Academic Health Center.
Thank you, Mr. Berg.
Okay. Any other questions or discussion before we vote on House File 572? All right. Not seeing any. Okay. So Representative Morrison's motion is that House File 572 be re-referred to the Taxes Committee. So, Ms. Niedernhofer, please take the roll on House File 572. The chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damoth.
Damoth votes aye.
Damoth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah.
Grunhagen, aye. Representative Keel. Excused. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Sorry, Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Quam, aye.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamont.
Aye.
Wolgamont, aye. Madam Chair, there are 18 ayes and zero nays.
All right. Well, there being 18 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevails and the bill is passed to the Tax Committee. Thank you very much, Representative Morrison. So members, and we're running just a tad ahead of schedule, which is great. And the next on the agenda is a bill with Representative Cagle, but she is presenting in another committee. So I think what we'll do is go ahead and I'll present my bill next, which is House File 1796. And then probably we'll be able to take a brief break after that, because normally this committee goes till 4:30. And I know that it's going to get very, very long if we don't take a break. So why don't I quickly do, I think it'll be fairly quick, House File 1796, and then we'll take the break after that. So I'm going to move that House File 1796 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And just to give everyone just a little bit of background, this is, you often hear me talk about how little transparency there is in our public programs, in our PMAP program, our prepaid medical assistance program, where we pay a capitated rate to managed care organizations. They do about 75% of our public programs. And we have a lot of discussion in this committee and others, and we have over the years, about what the payment rates are. How much do they pay for dental care? How much do they pay for a provider for any other kind of visit? And it's been a very difficult thing. And the argument is often made that we're not entitled to this. And we had even presentations from DHS earlier in this year. And Commissioner Matt Anderson, who's the assistant commissioner for the healthcare administration area, said straight out, you know, right, you can't have this information. What do they pay a provider? Well, this has always been very troubling to me. I know it's been troubling to many of you who've learned about this over the years, because as we all know, billions of dollars go through these programs. And our constituents believe that we are in charge and that we are managing this money. And we try, and sometimes we kind of try in vain. It's very frustrating. So there has been legislation passed over time, and it was in about 2015, we actually did pass a bill in the legislature that, and I'm just looking at my notes here, we did pass a bill. Okay, wrong page, let's see. There was a court decision, the Timberjay decision, that kind of got the ball rolling a little bit on this. And the Timberjay decision talked about when government turns its function over to a private entity, whether the privacy that the private entity can't then say that the data it gets from government is now private when it would have been public if government had it. So we passed legislation in 2015 that essentially required DHS to include in its contracts with the MCOs the provision that followed this legislation, and said even if they didn't, that the MCOs were going to have an obligation to share this data with the legislature, with the public, as a matter of fact. Now, there's still some debate because there are other provisions that arguably could put a limit on this. But since 2015 and the legislation went into effect, to my knowledge, nobody's really asked for the data. And so what this bill is doing is my way of beginning to actually ask for the data. So the bill is going to need some more work, because what I'm trying to do here, this little bill is just asking for an annual report from DHS that tells us in kind of summary form how much MCOs are paying providers for their services, but starts to give the legislature a window into how much are they actually paying. And it compares it to the fee-for-service rates, which are public. So that's what this bill is doing. I'm going to be laying this over. I'm going to continue to work on the language, because I want the language to be really meaningful, to make sure that the data that we get is not just a pile of numbers, but that we're getting something that we're going to be able to look at and say, aha, it looks like they pay a lot more in this county than in other counties, or, you know, to get some real sense of what are they doing with the money that we give them. So that's the purpose of the bill, members. And I would love to take questions, or frankly, I would love your suggestions, because this is something, and you can give them to me now, or you can give them to me offline. I would love to have your input, because I think that this is something that has troubled members on both sides of the aisle for a very long time. And I do think that we should push and try to get the information. And if the plans or DHS want to tell us that this goes beyond what is allowed under law, I think there might be a little bit of a test there just to see, because I do believe that we should be entitled to this information. We are appropriating the money, and we are accountable to our constituents for where it goes. So are there questions or discussion? I would just love to hear any feedback that members have. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned the original bill. Was that 2015 or 2018? I heard two numbers, and I wasn't sure. And can you also say, you know, if a bill passed, was there just no report at all provided, or was it up to the legislature to ask the question after the year was over? How did that play out?
So thank you for the question, Representative Bierman. I had asked House Research for some information on this some time ago, and it's a bit complicated, but It was 2014 that we actually passed a bill on the Timber J decision, and it had a delayed enactment date. And the idea was that there was going to be some kind of study. There was a mandated study to see what this would do in the healthcare marketplace, because the argument from the plans has always been, this will be terrible, this will upset everything we do, this will drive up costs, we won't be able to negotiate, all kinds of things like that. And so the report was given the time, so there was a delayed enactment to wait for this report. The report was given, nothing ever happened, and the bill went into effect. So that's what happened. And to my knowledge, since that time, nobody has actually said, okay, then, the law is a law. You know, nobody came back and said, oh, we can't do this, we need to change it. So the law went into effect, and there you go. I think we have some right to get this information. Representative Bierman?
Yes, Madam Chair, just one follow-up. Thank you. I think the next questions I was writing down was whether it would be county-based or by provider, how it would be reported, and you sort of answered that as far as it still being in the works. But it would seem to me the data is all there. It's not like we're asking onerous questions about collection. They have the data, DHS has the data. It's just in the format we would like to review it in. So thanks for the work so far, and anxious to see how we can make this go forward.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Absolutely. And I'm just trying to figure out how the data will be meaningful to us. I don't want to, you know, I remember one time years ago, probably before most of you were in the legislature with me, but in my early years of service on the HHS committees, where the plans, legislators were complaining about lack of data, and the plans brought in like a stack of paper and put it on each legislator in front of us in the committee room and said, here you go. I don't want that to happen. This is asking DHS to put the data in a form and in an amount, you know, not every piece of data they have, but just something that helps us understand and can compare. Representative Grunhagen is next.
Oh, thank you, Chairman Liebling. Yeah, have you talked to DHS? Do they have the report already, or what's their response? Because I mean, the law was a law. They've had a number of years here. So do they compile the information and they just don't send it out to anybody, or where's DHS on this?
So, Representative Grunhagen, great question. They've given me some technical assistance, which I will be incorporating into the bill. But this is not a report that they have, because they've never been asked to do a report on it. They, of course, collect data. They know they have data on how much is paid to providers by the MCOs, but I don't believe they have it in any kind of report form. So my goal here is not to make them do something onerous. It's just to give us data that they have in a way that will be meaningful to us. So if you have thoughts about that, I would, please do share them now or offline, would be great.
Yeah, for comparative purposes, right?
So we right.
can, between the providers, what their reimbursement rate is. Because I do think that they negotiate individually, and different providers are getting different reimbursement rates. You know, it just smells that way for what's that worth. But anyway, all right.
All right. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And yes, what I'm not trying to do is find out what they pay every individual provider, because that's where you get into where they complain that this is, it doesn't work for their negotiating, whatever. I'm trying to get some summary data that will still be meaningful to try to find the sweet spot, because there are still some complaints about if we go too far and we want the individual rates and that all becomes public, that then that destroys their ability to keep rates down and things like that. So Representative Ryer and then Pryor. Representative Ryan.
I can find my mute button. thank you, Madam Chair. Most of my questions were answered. I just want to express interest in understanding the granular detail, maybe not in this call, but for example, which services will be included in each of those categories and helping to think through some of the nuance related to care system level aggregation versus being able to break out at the county. And thank you for advancing this and pushing it along.
Well, thank you, Representative Breyer, and your expertise could be very helpful here. And if you, you know, anybody who has the time to look at the bill and give me your ideas, I would just love that. Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in the spirit of just kind of thinking about what this data and what this report could be, and just to give some reaction, it's also, it seems like whatever guidance we can get for how, if we receive the reports, how we would use the information to make better decisions. And I guess that if we were very clear on how, what our questions were and why we needed data to improve our work and our budgeting for things, then that would be, you know, then that could show the data rather than, I mean, something beyond, well, and then we would know. I guess then we would know because would be the next step. And I guess that's something that, you know, I think would be part of what we're looking for too. And then I also, and I open up this other side of the question, which is to know how much we're paying, but then what are we getting for it? You know, what are we getting for it in terms of outcomes? And how does that compare? So just that part of it too. So I seems like it's that we do want to be results based, and that's and as much as we can do that in the legislature, that we should be have cooperation with the executive branch for doing that. But I don't know exactly how that's done.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Breyer. That is absolutely a very good, very, very good point. And we do, you know, I think DHS does apply outcome measures, and there are quality measures that get applied in the contracts and so on. But I think you're right, and we should probably at some point when we have a bit more time, bring in DHS and have them explain some of that quality, or have the plans explain, you know, how do they do the outcome measures and so on. And, you know, we have the IHPs, which we heard about. It's all, you know, it gets very complicated. But thank you. That's a really good, very, very good thought. So with that, members, I'm going to lay over House File 1796 for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And I see that Representative Cagle is here. And let's see. It is 4:32. If members can hang on for a little longer, I think we could do Representative Cagle's bill and then take our break, if that's okay. I don't see anybody. Okay, good. I'm getting the thumbs up at least a little bit here. So, great. Okay, Representative Cagle, welcome. Representative Cagle's bill is House File 648. And the motion here is to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the health omnibus bill, health finance bill. So Representative Cagle, so the chair will make the motion since Representative Cagle is not on the committee. So welcome, Representative Cagle. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 648 is a bill that would prohibit health plans from putting an annual cap on testing for opioids. As part of a member of the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council or committee, I can't remember which one it is, but that we heard that this is a problem for people who are in treatment. And so when folks are in treatment for opioid use disorder, they tend to have to get urine analysis screenings, you know, at least once a week. And so we were hearing that the providers were only allowed to get about one per month. And so when they were doing these tests, they often were doing them and not being reimbursed for them. And so we worked with DHS and the health plans, and this is where we came to with this bill. making sure that folks can get the screening tests they need when they're when they have opiate use disorders.
Great. Well, that's great, Representative Cagle. Thank you for that. And do you, I don't know if you have the actual bill in front of you, but if you do, because we're in this virtual environment and it's hard for members to handle the paper and get the, I just wonder if you could just tell us kind of how you resolved the issue, because I know you, as you said, you did do some work on it in different committees and.
Sure, Madam Chair. So what we did is we just kind of clarified some of the language around annual caps. Instead of putting no limit, we had no annual cap. This also allows for the health plans to do a medical necessity review. So if they're seeing like a exorbitant number of tests coming from one facility or one provider, then they can go back and do a review to make sure that those are medically necessary. And then we did some a cross-reference for the public plans. And so theirs was a little bit different and needed to refer to laboratories and x-ray services. So there's also anybody who's on a public plan also will not have lifetime limits.
All right, great. And Representative Cagle, I'm looking here to see if we had a fiscal note, but I think I recall that there's no cost for the bill. Am I right?
Correct. So there is, Madam Chair, members, there was a completed fiscal note that came back as a zero.
Okay. Thank you very much. So are there any questions for Representative Cagle on House File 648? Representative Gernhagen.
Oh, I had trouble unmuting myself. Hey, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Representative Cagle, I don't see how you mandate additional coverage and there isn't a fiscal note. I don't understand. So this would apply to medical assistance, Minnesota Care, and the private health insurance plans, or just the private health insurance plans?
Representative Cagle.
Madam Chair and Representative Gruenhagen, so what we did is apparently the private or the public plans were already providing this service. And so what we did is we made sure that we were getting the public and private plans in line together. So there's no fiscal note because they're already providing those tests to people.
And maybe we could ask Mr. Berg to comment on that as well. Mr. Berg?
Madam Chair, yes, there are no, if you read the detail of the fiscal note, I mean, there are no costs in either medical assistance or Minnesota Care, or importantly, as you know, in the state employee group insurance program either. And there are no regulatory costs of commerce. The question I understand Representative Gruenhagen to be asking is if this constitutes a new insurance mandate under the meeting of the ACA. And if you members, I think, have the fiscal note, if you go to the Commerce Department's page, page 4 of the fiscal note, and you read under the assumptions, they say that this bill does not constitute a new mandate as understood under section 113.11. 1311D3 of the ACA. New under the ACA, new benefit mandates are not included as essential health benefits as specified, and this bill does not meet the definition of a new health mandate according to Commerce's interpretation.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Berg. And just for members to help you out, it's number 28. It's document 28 that was sent out by Mr. McQuillan, if you need to look for that. So other questions? Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, it's just hard to swallow that it's not a new mandate. I mean, I hear it, but it just doesn't register very well. And we're one of the top mandated coverage states in the United States. And of course, every mandate does drive up premiums. And we know premiums are unaffordable for people in many cases. It just, And okay, if this, you know, and I always had a theory when I was on the school board, if we had to add something on top because it was so necessary, then something has to drop off the bottom to balance it out, rather than just keep piling more mandates on. And I know they say it's not a mandate, but I've been in the health insurance industry for over 40 years, and I don't see how they come up with that conclusion, but maybe I'm reading English different than what they are.
Maybe you are, Representative Grunhagen. I think, you know, there it is. There it is. So.
All right.
All right. Thank you. All right. Representative Cagle, final word.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, Madam Chair, members. Really want to say that we had a couple bills that came out of the OREC committee, and this is one of them. And so we're working bipartisanly and on both sides of the street to get this done so that folks can get the treatment and care that they need when they're dealing with opioid use disorder. So thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Representative Cagle. And I've been reminded that it's House File 648, First Engrossment. And so House File 648, the First Engrossment, will be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Thank you so much. Okay, we are going to take a 10-minute recess so members can stand up and do what you need to do. It is 4:41 by my clock, so we'll come back at 4:52. All right. See you later, members. All right. Well, thank you for sticking with us, members. I know it gets to be a pretty long meeting as we are approaching deadlines here, and we have a lot of work to do, but we are moving along really well. So I'm hoping that we'll be perhaps ending a little bit earlier than our stated time this evening. So the next bill on the agenda is House File 2016, Representative Ryer. And Representative Ryer's motion is that House File 2016 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to present House File 2016. It's a Department of Health policy bill that modifies requirements for annual reporting on spending related to chronic conditions and risk behaviors. More specifically, MDH has four requirements. First, to identify healthcare spending directly attributable to diabetes, hypertension, dementia, obesity, and smoking, and all chronic disease costs for those 60 and over. So first identify, second, project future levels of condition attributable spending, and then compare that spending to the conditions and risk factors with the projection baseline. Finally, taking the share of the difference between those actual and projected spending amounts that can be attributed to state-administered programs. Basically an impact measurement. MDH is required to conduct the analysis annually, certify it, and deliver the findings to Minnesota Management and Budget so that the commissioner may initiate transfer of funds between the general fund and the healthcare access fund if the conditions in the statute are met performance-wise. Now, this bill proposes two changes, moving from annual to biannual reporting and removing costs related to the utilization of tobacco products. Both of these changes are grounded in ensuring that the data used to drive financial actions are up to the task. We need our reporting to be valid and reliable, which requires matching of the data and the reporting period to the need. In terms of data quality, this is a challenging task as researchers are working with claims data and linking and triangulating census and other survey and behavioral data. Each additional layer of data has its own assumption and brings its own noise. MDH makes a substantial investment in this work. The sophistication of these analyses requires a strong outside partner. So MDH works with Mathematica Policy Research, and the most recent cost was almost $300,000 for 2016 data analysis. Moreover, the MDH staff put in substantial times to supervise and provide technical assistance to the vendor and to interpret and communicate the results and implications. Regarding the reporting time period, this reporting seeks to measure changes from spending on chronic conditions that may not be quickly observable. Thus, seeing an annual impact may not be realistic, and over-reliance on annual reporting may be risky. This is particularly challenging with tobacco data, because tobacco exposure is poorly captured in claims data. Some of the tobacco-related survey data are collected only every other year. There's a long lag between starting to use tobacco and adverse health outcomes. And finally, costs associated with secondhand smoking exposure are difficult to determine. For these reasons, I support this bill and also ask for your support. In addition to improving the quality of the reports, I'd like to see the reporting team's time and budget freed up for other important analyses. With that, I will look forward to your questions, and I believe Stefan Gildemeister is also here to help with detailed or technical questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Ryer. Are there any questions on House File 2016? All right, I'm not seeing any. That was a really good explanation of what the bill is doing, Representative Ryer. Thank you very much for that. Okay, not seeing anything. So very good. You might get the prize for the shortest. Oh, there we go, Representative Pryor. Darn, almost got
No, I was just going to say, it's we're here, we were listening. you weren't talking to an empty Zoom room. I would expect nothing less.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you again, Representative Ryer. And with that, House File 2016 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Okay. Very good. Next up is Representative Bolden, House File 2055. And House File 2055, Representative Bolden's motion that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2055 is a straightforward Minnesota Department of Health policy bill aiming to add inclusivity and conformity to the International Medical Graduate Assistance Program language to include general surgery. In 2015, Minnesota legislatively created the International Medical Graduate Assistance Program to address barriers to practice and facilitate pathways to assist immigrant international medical graduates to integrate into Minnesota's healthcare delivery system. The program authorizes the Commissioner of Health to award grants to support primary care residency positions designated for Minnesota immigrant physicians who are willing to serve in rural or underserved areas of the state. Per the legislation, eligible primary care residency grant recipients include the following accredited residency programs: family medicine, internal medicine, obstetrics and gynecology, and psychiatry. This bill would add general surgery residency programs to that list. MDH was approached by staff at the University of Minnesota through the Office of the Dean Graduate Medical Education about feedback they received from general surgery residency program directors asking why they were excluded from the definition of primary care in the above-mentioned legislation. There was no specific reason as to why they were excluded. Other grant programs do include general surgery in the definition of primary care. It would be beneficial to expand the definition of primary care in the Internal Medical Graduate Assistance Program to include general surgery for a few reasons. One, it aligns this program with other grant programs. Two, it allows international medical graduates who have experience and interest in general surgery to continue in their area of practice, an area of practice that is needed in rural areas. And three, it also allows us to be responsive and to reasonable suggestions from the program. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll pause for any questions and note that we also have a representative from MDH to assist with any technical questions as needed.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Bolden. Are there questions from members? Okay, I don't see any. I have just a small question, Representative Bolden. So your explanation was really great, and So normally, I don't think of surgery as being part of primary care, but my understanding is that you're adding it to the definition, but only for purposes of this program. Am I correct there?
That is correct. So I actually had that thought initially too, but so you're correct. And I also would add that, you know, the other residency programs, so there's family medicine, internal medicine, obstetrics and gynecology, and psychiatry. So it fits in line with sort of the sort of package of those other residency programs. And this would be in line with other similar programs.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Representative Biermuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question for Rep. Bolden. Do you know the level of applicants that are applying for these grants and what the relative number is comparatively to the grants that are available?
Representative Bolden?
Thank you for that question, Representative Bierman. I do not have that information, but I know we do have, as I said, someone from DHS, MDH on the call who maybe would have that information.
Okay. Is there someone on the call that can respond to that?
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lisa Timian, and I'm Legislative Director at MDH. And I believe my colleague Yende Anderson is on and speak to the actual number because I do not have that handy. And if she doesn't, we can get back to the committee with that information later today.
All right. Thank you.
Hi, Lisa. I'm Chairwoman Representative Liebling. I do have a number available for you. Every year we have had at least two applicants for the residency program. This program encompasses other grants, but for the residency grant, we've had at least two, from one from the University of Minnesota and one or two from Hennepin Health.
All right, thank you. And could you just say your name and who you work for, just for the record?
I'm sorry. My name is Yende Anderson, and I work for Minnesota Department of Health.
All right, thank you. Representative Bierman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No other questions, just to comment. I think I like the grant program, the idea of helping out to get the doctors where we need them throughout the state. So thanks to Rep. Bolden for bringing it forward.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Any other questions or comments from members? Okay, not seeing any. So with that, we will lay over House File 2055 for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Thank you, Representative Bolden. Moving right along, next, Representative Jordan, I see that she is here, and she brings us House File 2048, and the chair will move that House File 2048 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Welcome, Representative Jordan. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and good evening, members of the committee. I'm honored to discuss House File 2048, an agency bill I've been working on with MDH, which would allow Minnesota to use the most recent and best possible science to protect all of us from exposure to carcinogens through our groundwater. MDH sets health risk limits for groundwater, determining health protective limits for concentrations of chemicals and possible carcinogens in our groundwater supply. And currently, MDH must rely upon data from the federal EPA. So as a result, MDH depends on data that's not always the most up-to-date or accurate because the EPA tends to be a little bit more slow-moving. So this bill would enable MDH to use other data and studies that have undergone scientific review and have been approved by the commissioner. So often information received from other sources, such as universities and state agencies, is quicker to follow the most recent research and science. This bill does not preclude MDH from using data from the EPA, but enables the commissioner to use the best possible information to protect Minnesotans' health and well-being. So in short, House File 2048 is more protective of Minnesotans and our groundwater. And with that, I, along with folks from MDH, are here to answer questions any members of the committee may have.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Jordan. We appreciate that. And we'll give members a minute or two if you have questions on House File 2048. And members will recall that it's a little bit not always intuitive for us that groundwater protection is, in fact, in Department of Health. I mean, it does make a lot of sense, but we don't think about it that way often. All right. I'm not seeing any questions. So I don't want to rush you if you have them, because we do have plenty of time. All right. Representative Grunhagen.
I hate to fail you, Chairman Liebling. Say, I understand the impetus behind this, Representative Jordan, and I know your concern, but I do think that the EPA is national, and I do have, it does cause me pause to put this much additional responsibility to MDH without a check and balance. And, you know, we already have agencies doing rulemaking, and I guess I'd like to leave it as it is. I need more information, but I'm just not ready at this point to turn that over to the MDH. So, okay, thank you. She can respond if she wants, but I just wanted to express my concern. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Do you want to respond to that, Representative Jordan? Because it seems like there's a little misunderstanding about what the bill actually does.
Sure. Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Grunhagen, for the question. I really do welcome the opportunity to talk about this. So this allows the commissioner to continue to use the EPA, and it actually says that they should use the EPA is still cited in the statute. This just also allows MDH to use other data to protect Minnesotans from carcinogens in drinking water. I know that if there is research from the University of Minnesota, for example, or a study done by MDH that says that there are carcinogens in my groundwater that my constituents drink water from the Mississippi. But if there is groundwater, which is a source of drinking water for many Minnesotans that has carcinogens in it, I want us to have the most up-to-date and accurate information to be able for MDH to use to make these decisions. So I think it's just really important that this gives MDH more tools in their toolbox to protect our drinking water.
All right. Yeah. Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for that response, Representative Jordan. You know, I did serve on the subcommittee of water, clean water, for a couple of years. And one of the things that came out there is that the some of the MPCA and agencies were using non-peer-reviewed science to set requirements. And even a couple of the DFL representatives had concerns about that. It just gives me pause. I just think if there's additional data MDH has, they could ask for a waiver or submit it to the EPA. And I don't see why they wouldn't give them a waiver or show some concern. But I guess at this point, I really can't support this. I have agencies in general need some checks and balances. And this tends to go the opposite direction that I would be comfortable with. Anyway, those are just my comments. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Next, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Jordan, for bringing the bill forward. It seems to me that the more people we have checking on our water supply and how good it is a good thing, an important thing. And I'm just wondering about the intersect between the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Minnesota Department of Health. What are the lines between them, if any? And also, do you know how frequently the water quality is checked for the sources of water for Minneapolis area? Is it yearly or monthly? Or when was the last time the water source was really looked at in terms of, you know, how healthy it is for drinking. I know Minneapolis gets a lot of water from just the north part of the metro Mississippi area is what I understood, and they don't do as many checks on that as I thought. So just a lot of questions there, but just wanted to get a sense of that.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think those would be really great questions for MDH to answer.
Who do we have here from MDH that can take those questions?
I can and can certainly do that, Madam Chair.
All right, Mr. Kelly, please introduce yourself.
My name is Jim Kelly, and for the record, I work for the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm the manager of the Environmental Surveillance and Assessment section. So a couple things there. With regards to the monitoring of the source waters, say for the city of Minneapolis, which is the Mississippi River, we have a significant project at this point that's going on from our drinking water protection program that's looking at the quality of source waters around the state, especially surface waters, where we're sampling for a wide range of contaminants just to see what potentially is upstream of the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul's, for that matter, water intakes. Data will be coming out of that that effort later this year, and it is something that the city, of course, has to monitor on a frequent basis what's coming into the plant so that they can take action quickly to turn off the intakes if there is some sort of a spill or something going on upriver. So I think we have a pretty robust system for looking for those contaminants and responding in a timely manner if it becomes necessary.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Representative Bierman, anything further?
No, that's good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Representative Morrison and then Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to thank Representative Jordan for bringing this bill forward. Our water is our most precious resource in Minnesota in many ways, and it is under threat from all kinds of different directions. And if anything, I would say that the pendulum has swung toward not many checks and balances on industry. So I appreciate having more eyes on water than fewer, and I applaud the Department of Health's work on it already and their future involvement if need be, as the bill enumerates. If monitoring shows that there is degradation. So thank you, Representative Jordan.
All right, thank you. And Representative Munson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I know we heard a bill, I think we heard a bill similar to this before. My concerns are really around the intersection between the Minnesota Department of Health and in the Department of Ag. This bill really, I think, would impact agricultural practices upstream from the cities. And my concerns are around kind of getting involved with what chemicals farmers use kind of overlapping what the Department of Ag does. Is this bill going to the Ag Committee as well, or where does the, Minnesota Department of Ag have authority to regulate chemicals that are used in farming practices versus where the Department of Health now would be involved? I guess we'd ask maybe the Department of Health.
So Mr. Kelly might be the best one to answer that. Let me take a stab at it, though, Mr. Kelly. Tell me if I'm wrong. I would guess that the Department of Ag's business ends where our drinking water starts. But you please, you answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. That's basically correct. Our role in the Groundwater Protection Act of the Department of Health is to simply establish the thresholds that define the level of a contaminant in groundwater that's safe for human consumption for up to a lifetime. That's really the extent of it. When it comes to the application of those values out in the environment, so to speak, that is the purview of both the Department of Agriculture when it comes to pesticides and fertilizer use, as well as the Pollution Control Agency when it comes to chemical spills and releases. So they simply look to us for the barometer, the benchmark, to define what's an acceptable level of contamination in groundwater. Then they have other provisions of the Groundwater Protection Act that they apply as necessary to impact the use of chemicals on the land that could then contribute to groundwater contamination. So our role is fairly limited in simply setting that benchmark. And consulting with them if they have questions about how that maybe should be applied when it comes to their programmatic areas.
Representative Munson, anything further?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that we all want clean water, but we also want food, and so we need to balance those two priorities. So, yeah, thank you.
Well, Representative Munson, we might differ about how we balance those priorities. I think that if our water is poisoning us, then I think we got some problems. Representative Backer?
Yeah, I have a question here. And this probably goes to the author, but in regards with this bill here, do we trust MDH to with the power to, you know, single-handedly set health risk limits? That would, it seems like we're putting a lot of emphasis in one department.
Representative Jordan, do you want to take that?
Yes, Madam Chair. We already do. That's the bill right now just would change the difference in what data the commissioner will use. So right now the law says that they must use data from the federal EPA or the EPA and other sources. This law, only thing this law changes is that it says is the word or. It's the word and from or. So that's already the law, Representative Baker.
Okay,
and let's go back. It has other things to say more about that.
Representative Backer, follow up.
Yeah, Representative Jordan, that still concerns me. Even though it's the law, doesn't mean it's correct. I know what you're trying to get to. You know, my concern is this would even, you know, and means you have to get two things to happen, or means one or the other. I get that, but I still have concerns that MDH would have single-handedly. We're making an assumption that they have the right data. Now, I get it that you want to have EPA also weigh into it too, but it seems to me even giving more power to agencies and, like, that's what it concerns me. Because if we would have more stringent limits, even though, you know, the data may not be accurate, does put limitations on there. I think at the end of the day, we all want to make sure that we're getting safe resources, but that just would be my concern. I want to share that for the record. I do appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for a second question. I just wanted to ask Mr. Kelly, please, for the relative size of the Minnesota Department of Health, the number of people who are looking at the water issues versus how many people are looking at it from the EPA side.
Mr. Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a hard question for me to answer specifically because I'm not as well versed in what the EPA's resources are. We have a unit of scientists that conduct this work on behalf of the department of about 8 people. EPA certainly has many different staff scattered across institutions around the country. But as I think the author pointed out, they're sometimes not as quick as they could be when it comes to updating the science around specific chemicals, especially chemicals that could be of concern to the state of Minnesota. So I can't comment specifically as to how many resources the EPA has. I can only speak to what I have in my own agency.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kelly. And so that's kind of the point of my question. I'm just wondering, you know, if we don't know what the EPA is looking at and how intentional their work is on our water, it would behoove us to make sure with our own staff on something as critical as water that we're on top of it. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. I'm going to take the last question from Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author. You know, the simple replacing an and with an or raises some concern with me. The EPA is involved in a lot of international activity. It's an outfit that has a lot of information. I know that we may be cooperative with the Great Lakes on some international work on water quality, but an and means that we need to review and look at what the federal government, which has a much broader staffing and exposure to information, where an or allows the possibility that we just sort of stop listening to what they have and maybe don't hear things that we ought to. So my concern is I like and because you have a broader view, and I have concerns about what do you lose when you stop looking at the federal. So what would the author be able to tell me what things that we have as a state that absolutely fully encompass everything that the EPA would have so that we don't lose anything when we drop them out with the and just allow the or?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Kwan, for the question. I don't think we lose anything. We're not getting rid of the EPA. We're expanding the tools for MDH to assess carcinogens in our groundwater supply. If there's carcinogens that are affecting the water that my constituents drink, I want MDH to be able to use the data and to find that out to protect my constituents. We're not losing anything. We're expanding the scope of what MDH can use to protect Minnesotans. So that's why I really like this rule change, and that's why I'm really happy to work with them on this bill.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Representative Jordan, and thank you, members, for the questions. And I just, before I lay this bill over, I would just say that I like the idea that the people who are testing the groundwater are also drinking it. These people live in Minnesota. So I think it's comforting to me. They're protecting their own homes and families as well. So with that, thank you, Representative Jordan. House File 2048 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Our final bill for the evening, and we are nicely ahead of schedule, is House File 447, Representative Akam. So she is not on the committee, so the chair will move that House File 447 be re-referred to State Government Finance and Elections Committee. So this is one that we'll be voting out. And Representative Akam, welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 447, a bill to improve breast cancer screening. Dana Carter with the Susan G. Komen Organization has submitted some written testimony in lieu of an appearance today. As many of you know, breast cancer is one of the most common forms of cancer affecting women. In fact, 1 in 8 of all women will be diagnosed with breast cancer at some point in their lifetime. In Minnesota alone, 4,850 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer, and 640 will die from the disease this year alone. Breast cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in women. To combat this, the medical community agrees on the benefit and value of early diagnosis. According to the American Cancer Society, women with breast cancer identified and treated early have a 5-year survival rate of 99% compared to a projected 28% survival rate for those diagnosed late. As a result, regular mammograms are among the basic preventative services recommended by the federal government and are covered by most insurance plans nationwide at no cost to the patient. When a woman's regular screening, a mammogram, indicates something unusual, her doctor often orders a follow-up diagnostic scan to clarify the issue. To most women, any follow-up test is still part of the overall preventative screening process. However, follow-up diagnostic testing is not always free and can be subject to a wide variety of cost-sharing terms established by individual health plans. This can create an unintended financial barrier for women to this important health screening process. I have personally seen this problem myself. In the past, my doctor brought me back for follow-up testing after a routine mammogram showed an area of concern. When arranging the second appointment, I remember the scheduler telling me that I would need to pay $150 for the follow-up procedure, even though the first mammogram was free. I questioned this since my doctor ordered the second test to fully evaluate my initial screening. She said it was due to my health insurance, but that I was worth it, and whatever the cost was. I did think I was worth it, and I believe all women are worth it. For the same reason that preventative mammograms are free, this bill seeks to ensure that no woman postpones or foregoes completing their breast cancer screening due to financial barriers. Some might argue that this is an added health insurance mandate that will increase costs, but I disagree. When the federal government established preventative guidelines for mammograms, they did so on strong scientific evidence that doing so would reduce deaths, increase survival rates, lengthen life expectancy, and save money. In fact, the CDC cites multiple studies on their website that show breast cancers diagnosed in early stages are much less expensive to treat than those diagnosed at a late stage. Free preventative breast cancer screenings are already a basic requirement for health plans precisely because they are effective and save money. Any additional tests needed to clarify the findings of those regular mammograms should be part of that same free process. I am a breast cancer survivor myself, and I believe my success is due to early diagnosis and treatment. I also believe that all women should have barrier-free access to early diagnosis and the same chance to overcome cancer that I was given. I would ask for your support of House File 447, and I stand for questions.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Acom. So are there questions from members? Representative Damuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Acom, for bringing this forward. I, too, am a breast cancer survivor, and if we were in the same room, I would high-five you at the end of our hearing. So we'll, so we'll virtual do that. But I do have a couple of questions. I do have a couple of questions on the bill. We know that this is important, that early diagnosis. I fully agree with that. As you related that story of when your doctor calls you back for the next test, you know, everything that goes with that. And I agree that finances shouldn't be a barrier, but knowing how important it is, I see in the bill, and I believe it's line 112, that we are exempting. It doesn't apply to medical assistance or Minnesota Care. Do you know what our Minnesota Care people may be having to pay for secondary testing? And if you or want to relate that to someone else, if you could just answer that question. I do believe that it is important.
Representative Acom.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Damuth, and congratulations on your beating breast cancer. So truly, I think it should go to all programs, you know, public and private insurance. And really, it was budgetary that I opted to do this, given the budget situation in the state as we started out the session. It's a little different scenario today. But I did reach out to Doug Berg, and there's a fiscal note that's being put together, and I did ask him to see if he could help me find out if what the cost would be to those people with Minnesota Care and medical assistance. And so I did check with him before committee started today, and he had not heard back anything, so I don't have that information, but I'm looking for it, and I will certainly pass it on when I do have that.
All right. Representative Damuth, anything further?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just as a follow-up then, I would be interested when you gave the stat of 1 in 8, and we know that well, but I would be interested in the number that that actually affects. Thankfully, there's 7 in 8 that don't get that call back, and so maybe our number is a little bit smaller than we're thinking. But thank you very much for bringing this forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Damuth. And I wonder if there's anybody from DHS who can answer the question, because my understanding is that on our MA program, of course, the out-of-pockets are very low. So I don't know. I doubt very much there's a $150 charge for a second follow-up that's necessary. And in addition, even in our Minnesota Care program, our out-of-pockets, while they're a bit higher, are also very low. So Geogo, welcome. Good introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Member Geogo Hayes with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. So to answer the question, we do have, I believe it's a $3 copay for non-preventative visits in the Medicaid program. That's stipulated in state law. And then in Minnesota Care, we also have a copay. I don't remember exactly what it is off the top of my head, and I apologize, but the program itself has a 94% actuarial value. So recipients only paying 6% of the aggregate care that they're receiving in the Minnesota Care Program. So it certainly is unlikely to hit that $150 mark that was mentioned earlier. But if there was interest in making the change, there would be a slight cost, likely a slight cost to the
Thank you very much, Mr. Hayes. And, you know, obviously, I would just want to be sure to note that for the people who's, you know, people are on these programs because their incomes are lower. So, of course, a $3 charge for someone on MA can be quite a bit, as could, you know, on the Minnesota Care program, because these are, by definition, low-income folks. So thank you. Okay, Representative Ackland and then Quam. Representative Ackland. And you are muted.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question's for Representative Akam. And I don't want this question to be understood as a suggestion, and I don't want it to be understood as a criticism either. But I just felt like we need to maybe talk through this a little bit. So you've chosen the mammograms for additional testing, or additional testing related to mammograms, instead of possibly another diagnostic test. So you mentioned some of the statistics around breast cancer, but I know that heart disease is the number one killer of women in the United States, and I am a personal survivor of heart disease. I know that the number two killer of women in the United States is cancer, but it's not breast cancer. The number two killer is lung cancer, and breast cancer is number three. So my question comes to you, and like I said, not in the way of a criticism, but just as we're going down this path, it makes me wonder, why would we choose one diagnostic test to the exclusion of other diagnostic tests and move down that path? So, for instance, if you have a mammogram and you need additional testing, you might get first an ultrasound, then you might get an MRI, then you might get a possible biopsy. Then that biopsy would require a pathology test. And so the path can go pretty far. But the same way happens with heart disease. You go to the doctor with a twinge in your chest, you get an EKG, maybe you need a treadmill, maybe you need an angiogram, oh, maybe you need a stent, maybe you need open heart surgery. Well, all those tests leading up to it. So I just am coming to you with the question. I understand breast cancer is very well known, so is heart disease. And so as far as this bill is concerned, I'm just wondering, and I don't even know exactly how to ask the question, it's just that to pick this one and say you can get this test and no further diagnostic test doesn't seem to me to fit into our bigger picture that number one, heart disease is actually number one killer of women. So why would we not pick that disease, or why would we not pick lung cancer since it's the number two? So that's my question. Thank you.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Ackland. I picked this bill and this cause because I experienced it. And so I think, you know, we have this representative government where we all come here with our perspective and with our experience. And it's hopeful that then that represents our community. And I haven't experienced heart disease, and so I'm not as familiar with that. I went through the experience of being diagnosed with breast cancer, and I think that for those of us that are women, we've had, many of us anyway, have had mammograms at least, you know, once or annually or however often you get them. And when we go through a process and we see an area that can be improved upon, I think we take note and we work to make things better. And that's why I'm here at the legislature. And so that's why I'm presenting this bill.
Representative Ackland, anything else?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me as if it'd be a simple oral amendment to fix the neglect of covering this for Minnesota Care and MA. To me, if this is a very good program, why are we not making it universal? And so Yeah, I assume the author would love to have it fully cover. So you being the chair, can we address this now?
Representative Quam, no, we can't. And Representative Akam has said that she's looking into what the cost would be, and it's her bill, and we do have a 24-hour rule. So, no, we're not going to, like, blow up her bill right now, or maybe it won't blow up her bill. I don't know, but it's really up to Representative Akam to deal with the bill, and we're going to vote it out to, you know, in its present form to state government finance, and if she is able to amend the bill, and, you know, we'll bring it back if we're going to have costs that are carried in our committee, but I'm not at this time expecting that. So
Madam Chair,
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For this session, there will be never any simple oral amendments accepted by the chair.
Well, Representative Quam, it's always the chair's discretion about whether an oral amendment is simple. This is not a simple amendment. It's a big change to her bill. So if there was a small issue, technical, something that needed fixing, probably that would be okay. In my judgment, that's not what this is. So we're not going to accept that oral amendment at this time. So, are there further questions from members before we vote on the bill? All right, I'm not seeing any. I just would comment myself that I think that this bill and the discussion, which I appreciate the discussion, and Representative Backlund, I think we accept your comments as they're offered. I don't think you need to, at least for my part, I don't view them as being brought in any kind of, you know, negative spirit. But I think it does bring a good question. And for me, what this bill highlights is how dysfunctional our system of insurance really is. That, you know, some of us are discussing here today, you know, if you find that you're ill and you need care, and suddenly, even though you're carrying insurance and probably in many cases paying a lot of money for that insurance, suddenly it's on you. It's out of your pocket. And that may, in fact, deter your care. And it may mean that you don't get care that you desperately need, that you don't get that follow-up because you can't afford to pay for it. That is a serious problem that Representative Akam is really bringing before us. And, you know, one small bill is not going to be able to fix that problem. She's trying to fix it in a sphere that she cares deeply about. And I think Representative Backlund quite rightly brings up the fact that, you know, it's kind of luck of the draw, which disease you get and which thing affects you and your loved ones. And personally, I would argue that that's why our system is really a bad one, because if you need health care, you should get it and you shouldn't be deterred, especially from life-saving, absolutely necessary health care or health care to keep you healthy, because you can't afford that out-of-pocket cost. Our system of out-of-pockets has gotten way, way out of whack. Frankly, I don't think it has any place in healthcare, and that's the system we've got. So thank you, Representative Akam. Would you like the final word, and then we'll take the roll call on your bill?
Well, I thank you all for the discussion this afternoon, and I appreciate the opportunity to present my bill, and I would ask for your support.
All right. So we're going to take the roll on the bill, and Ms. Niedernhofer, who's our steadfast roll taker here, is having power problems at her home. So let's see. Her bandwidth is very low. She's going to try to do the roll call, and if she finds herself unable to do that, I will actually continue that. It'll be a first for me, but we'll try to do it one way or another. Ms. Niedernhofer, are you able to do it? My chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Hewitt, aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, no.
Ackland, no. Representative Backer.
No.
Becker, no. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth?
Aye.
Damuth, aye. Representative Freiberg?
Aye.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen?
No.
Grunhagen, no. Representative Keel? Excused. Representative Morrison?
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson?
Munson, no.
Munson, no. Representative Pryor?
Aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam? Representative Quam?
Aye.
Quam, aye. Representative Breyer?
Aye.
Breyer, aye. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott?
Wolgamott, aye.
Wolgamott, aye. Madam Chair, there are 13 ayes and 5 nays.
All right. There being 13 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to state government finance. Thank you very much, Representative Akam. All right, members, thank you for the good discussion this evening. Thank you for sticking around. We are ending a little bit earlier than we had thought, so that's kind of a blessing to us. Appreciate the good discussion this evening. So we will be meeting tomorrow at 3 o'clock and taking up a number of bills that I won't read to you, but they're on our agenda for tomorrow. So with that, have a great evening. We are adjourned.